Milwaukee Journal Sentinel Brewers podcast joins you here in the offseason. We've got some awards to discuss. As expected, Christian Yelich, Milwaukee Brewers outfielder, is the National League MVP in the year 2018. That decision came down Thursday. Not a surprise. Everyone kind of thought that's where we were headed, and it turned out to be the case. He wins handily and gets recognized for what was certainly one of the most memorable second half performances in Brewers history, and really overall on the season. He's among the league leaders in a number of categories. He is a newly minted National League MVP. And let's talk about it. My name is J.R. Radcliffe, host of the Milwaukee Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. I'm going to be joined shortly by Tom Haudricourt. We're going to talk about the Christian Yelich success story, as well as a little bit about Craig Counsell, who on Tuesday was the runner-up in the Manager of the Year voting, announced as the runner-up in the National League Manager of the Year voting. Brian Snitker of the Atlanta Braves wins the award. It was a pretty close vote, but for the most part, Snitker was kind of handily winning that one. I don't know if fans are upset by that. I think they're probably, Brewers fans are a little disappointed that Craig Counsell did not win that award after the Brewers surged late in the season to win a franchise record 96 games, have the best the most wins in the National League, and winning the NL Central. They ultimately, of course, went to Game 7 of the NLCS, even though the votes were in by then. It's a regular season award. I know fans probably thought that the Brewers weren't necessarily expected to do that, should get some credit there and get have Craig Counsell be the Manager of the Year. The Braves, though, really had a heck of a turnaround. They went from a team that was completely out of the race to the NL East champion this year. They were not predicted to do this quite yet. They had some great performances from some young players, notably NL Rookie of the Year Ronald Acuna. Also, Ozzie Albies became sort of a household name this season. So the Braves probably had a little bit higher degree of difficulty, and we can argue about whether the Manager of the Year award is even a fair judgment that we make, because it's really hard to say exactly what impact a manager has. Pretty much all you have are what you expect a team to do versus what they actually do, which is usually attributable to a number of things that have nothing to do with the manager, or just only something to do with the manager. And yet that's kind of the basis for the Manager of the Year award. But whatever, the Brewers do not win two major awards. They have now four managers, Tom Treblehorn, Ron Renicki, and Phil Garner, the other three, who finished second in Manager of the Year voting. This is an award that's been handed out since 1983. So Harvey Keene in 82, I have a feeling he would have definitely won the award that year. They won the most games. He was a midseason replacement to a team that was kind of floundering, and then only led them to the World Series, seventh game of the World Series. He probably would have won in 82, but the award has only been handed out since 83. Brewers have had a lot of close calls, but never actually a winner in that category. They do, however, have their first batting title in franchise history, that belonging to the newly minted NL MVP. They've had others who have won this award, Riley Fingers, Robin Yount. So it's not, of course, Ryan Braun in 2011. So it's not completely unheard of for a Milwaukee Brewers player to hoist this trophy. Still a pretty sweet thing all the same. So I talked to Tom about Craig Counsell and Christian Yelich, as well as a little bit at the end about the Gold Glove. We talked about that already, but the Gold Glove snub of Lorenzo Cain, the changes to the coaching staff, and kind of if the maneuver to get Christian Yelich and Lorenzo Cain on the same day this offseason, with the success of that, will the Brewers be emboldened to make some big moves this offseason, which basically is here? We could start hearing about player maneuvers at any moment. Some minor ones have already kind of come down, so we will certainly find out. But here is Tom Haudricourt talking all about it. Here now is Tom Haudricourt, Brewers beat reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We're going to start with our awards chatter about the. We'll start with the Manager of the Year, with Craig Counsell taking second to Brian Snitker of the Atlanta Braves in the voting there. Counsell now one of four Brewers managers in club history who have taken second place, but the Brewers have never had a winner. So, Tom, you voted in these sorts of things before, and we all know that the votes are due by the end of the regular season, but I'm kind of curious a little bit on process, just what you know about the voting and what you've done. Do writers turn those in advance? Because you look at what the Brewers did the last couple weeks of the season, and you could see how that would actually sway somebody to vote for Craig Counsell, to recognize what the Brewers did late in the year to win 96 games. But do guys kind of make up their minds when they're voting earlier in the month of September, or do you think it comes down to those last few days?
Well, I do think that most of the voters wait as long as they can. You know, you have to have your ballot in before the first playoff game, which would this year would have been the National League wild card game. But I don't see any reason why you would make up your mind ahead of time on things like that. So I always turn my ballots in. I did not have a manager of the year, but I did have rookie of the year and MVP this year because we have a small chapter, the baseball writers chapter, and so a lot of us double up on votes. So this year I had two different votes, rookie and MVP. And so as long, you know, I always wait till the season's played out. You know, this year the Brewers played game 163, and that was a regular season game, so that game counted too. So if you were going to give any extra points to a manager, Craig Counsell would have got some that day by beating the Cubs and winning the NL Central title. They were five games back on Labor Day. So, you know, that was a close vote. Brian Snicker had 116 points, Counsell 99. That's very close as far as the balloting can go. And so, you know, you can make a case for both of them very strongly. Yeah, I do think, and when I've had the manager of the year ballots in the past, I do think often it's maybe instead of calling it manager of the year award, we should call it beating the expectations award. It's kind of the team that beats expectations. I think the Brewers' expectations were not exceeded as greatly this year as the Braves, because the Braves lost 90 games last year and finished 25 games out. And the Brewers won, you know, missed by one game last year of the wild card, and then this year won the division. So a lot of times I think people do the math on wins and losses, and when you do that, the Braves were like plus 18 and the Brewers were plus 10. And I do think people kind of look at that. But it is sort of like what expectations are. And I think sometimes the managers of the teams that win big, when they're expected to win big, get shortchanged on the voting, you know, because it doesn't mean you still didn't do a great managerial job, you know. For example, I think probably Joe Maddon had to manage his butt off this year for the Cubs as opposed to the year that they won the World Series, you know. So, and I do think there's no question that Counsell was in a tougher environment in September than the Braves were. You know, nobody challenged them in the NL East, and that was not expected. You know, the Phillies fell off the face of the earth at the end of the season and barely won a game, and the Washington just could not get going. But that still doesn't change the fact that the Braves were a very young team who probably greatly exceeded expectations. I compare them a lot to last year's Brewers team in that they arrived ahead of schedule in their rebuild, but they really arrived ahead of schedule. They got to the playoffs.
Yeah, it certainly helped having rookie of the year Ronald Acuna show up and do what he did this season. But so you're talking about something that I think we hear a lot when the manager of the year is awarded, just whether or not we really should even give out manager of the year, because it is sort of weighed against expectations and what you did last year, and it is sort of a, I don't know if we can really gauge how strong a performance a manager gives. Do you feel that as well, that there's just no way to really look at a manager and say, okay, that guy did a great job? Obviously, you have a better perspective on what Craig Counsell did, but it's hard to compare that to what Brian Snitker did because you weren't there in the clubhouse. You don't know how he managed personalities or what maneuvers he specifically made.
Right. I think it was Earl Weaver who said, "Show me a good manager and I'll show you 25 good players."
Yeah, you bet.
You know, I always say Sparky Anderson got really dumb at the end of his career in Detroit when he stopped winning, because guess what? He stopped having great players. So, I have a unique perspective of this year's race because I know Brian Snicker very well. I covered the Richmond Braves, the AAA Richmond Braves in the 80s, in the early 80s. And he was a coach on that team. And that's also how I met my wife. She was working in the front office of that team. And so they were actually co-employees, you know, fellow employees of the Atlanta Braves, because Atlanta owned that team and later moved it out of Richmond, unfortunately. But so he's been in that organization for 40 years, and I thought Craig Counsell was very magnanimous in his comments after the voting came down, where he congratulated Snicker for hanging with an organization for 40 years and finally getting the chance. It's, you know, he's probably unique in that you don't see anybody stay with an organization for 40 years and then get a chance to manage the major league team, you know, and much of that was in the minor leagues coaching and managing. And so it's a very good story there for Brian Snitker. And so I had that that unique perspective, and I was you know, personally happy for Snip, as we call him, because talk about paying your dues. You know, he going back to when he played for the Braves, he had been in the organization. He has been in the organization since 1977. Imagine that.
Yeah, especially in today's day and age where guys pretty much retire and become big league managers like within a year or two. How many guys have we seen who just finished their playing career? Kind of Craig Counsell is in that boat too. And I'm curious how you think, is there another universe where Craig Counsell would be a manager for any other team other than the Brewers? This seems like such a match made in heaven because of his, you know, his background here growing up here. And then he was in the front office when he was promoted in 2015 when he became, you know, when he became manager when the team fired Ron Renicki. Is this just a job that you think Craig Counsell took because he's a hometown guy, or would he have, you know, would he have pursued a managerial opening if it had been in another market?
Well, he's been linked to other managerial jobs before the Brewers made him their manager, but it's just a perfect fit, an absolutely perfect fit. And you know, unfortunately, no manager manages forever. So there's going to be a day when he's going to stop being the Brewers manager, and that has the chance to be a very awkward situation. But I don't think that's going to come anytime soon. And, you know, they signed Craig to a 3-year extension last year, so he's signed for a few more years. So it's many things that make his situation unique, not the least of which is he was on board before the general manager, David Stearns, came on board, and it hardly ever works that way. Usually the GM comes in and brings in his own manager at some point, but he and Craig, Stearns and Craig, have worked so well together, and they've made a really good duo. So it's you know, it's led to very good things. I don't think anybody thought when the Brewers started their rebuild in 2015 that they'd be missing the World Series by one game 3 years later. So it's been just an absolutely perfect fit. And you know, while all the players scatter, you know, at the end of the season, Craig Counsell stays right here, lives in Milwaukee, so he's not hard to find.
No, he's putting up with the cold like the rest of us here in the middle of November. Where do you feel like Craig Counsell makes the most difference? The thing people see is the bullpen management. Maybe they see his disposition a little bit as just a guy who doesn't get caught up in individual outcomes and looks at the big picture. But you saw him so often this year. What do you think sets him apart and makes him just, not even from a fit perspective, but from a manager perspective, what makes him so good at this?
Well, I do think, you know, that being a manager is a communication job. And if you don't have good communication in respect of your players, it's usually not, you're not going to succeed. And I do think that he has been very good in that regard. And, you know, a lot of the team's grittiness and spunkiness, if you will, kind of comes from him. Look at what he did. He'll tell you, with very modest talents, he made a 15-year career in the major leagues. And so, and he's not that far removed from the game either. He last played in 2011. So it's interesting that he played on the last playoff team in 2011 and then managed the next playoff team in 2018. So he just has a unique perspective in so many different ways, and it's a very, very unique situation. So as far as having great stories about managing, both Snitker and Counsell have pretty good stories.
Counsell also on the 2008 Brewers team that went to the playoffs, so he's their good luck charm here in the modern era.
He is, you know, and he was the good luck charm for the Florida Marlins and Arizona Diamondbacks too. So he's kind of like the Forrest Gump of baseball. He keeps showing up in the right place at the right time.
Of course, you could say the same about Ryan Braun from the Brewers. He has been here throughout as well. But yes, Craig Counsell named second place finisher in the NL Manager of the Year race. Let's shift to the race that we kind of saw coming. Christian Yelich named the National League MVP. I personally thought this was a slam dunk when we saw the three finalists and didn't see any of the pitchers. I thought maybe sort of a philosophical debate between pitcher and hitter. You might see maybe Jacob DeGrom squeak out a win there. But I guess that's where I want to start. Are you surprised we didn't see any of the pitchers, that this continues to be a sort of a hitters-only award with some obvious exceptions, but it seems like people really want the MVP to be just for the hitters?
Well, I think pitchers slip into the MVP picture in years in which there's no really good offensive players, and those years don't come around very often. This year, it was candidates aplenty offensively in the National League. This was a really good year. I had MVP ballot, and I, you know, did not lack for coming up with 10 names. I had to eliminate some guys because unlike some of the other ballots, you do have 10 names that you put on the MVP ballot, and it's weighted very heavily at the top, as it should be. But there were some great performances, and there were multiple great performances. And on the Brewers team alone, you had three guys that needed to be considered on the ballot, and Yelich, Kane, and Aguilar. And you know, the Rockies had a couple, and Story and Arenado, and it just went on and on and on. So many good candidates, and so I don't think this was a year when a pitcher was going to slip in and steal votes away. You know, there's a lot of people who just don't believe it. A pitcher who pitches in 30 games should be considered against a position player who plays 150, 155 games. And so that's a philosophical debate that we don't really need to get into. But I do think that players that play every day and have tremendous impact should be considered over pitchers. And just look at the impact that Yelich had, especially down the stretch. You know, a lot of people refuse to associate the MVP with a winning team. They think it's that he should stand alone just on his own performance. And that's a debate that's never going to go away. And people just don't want to think most valuable means most valuable on a winning team. But I do think the pressures that you face down the pennant stretch. Look at what the Brewers had to do just to get in the playoffs. They won their last eight games of the regular season, and if they lose any of those games, they don't win the division. And if they lose two or three of them, they don't even get the wild card. You know, so, and Yelich was leading the way. He had just a second half for the ages, one we may never see again. His numbers in the second half were just silly, silly good. And then in September, even more so. And just one of those performances that's going to go down as one of the greatest performances in Brewers history. And just across the board, too. I mean, I considered it at the very end, despite all the debates about Javi Baez and Arenado and Story and Matt Carpenter. Consider this. Just look at it. If you want to just divorce MVP's performance from his team's performance, let's do that. And let's look at Christian Yelich's individual performance. Batting average, .326 first. The Brewers' first batting champion ever, as hard as that is to believe. Slugging, .598 first. OPS 1,000 first, the only guy with four digits in the National League. Total bases 343 first. OPS plus 164 first. WRC plus 166 first. Weighted OBA 422 first. RBIs 110 second. Runs 118 second. Home runs 36 third. OBP 402 third. Do we need to go any farther than that? There's no one else that has that combination of numbers. He almost won the Triple Crown.
Right, and we can't discount his defense either. He's not Lorenzo Cain out there. He has won a Gold Glove in the past, and no one's going to mistake him for an elite defender, but he's credible. He's not
a finalist for the Gold Glove in left field, even though he kind of split left field and right field. So he's just an all-around good player. I love watching him run the bases.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And I'm not talking about stealing. I'm talking about just run the bases. Well, yes. One of the things that was really great about the Yount-Molitor era was watching those two guys run the bases. and they just were perfect in execution. And Yelich is very, very good at running the bases. You know, he's got those giraffe legs, you know, and I kid him all the time. I say, you're 6 foot three, but, you know, 6 foot one of it is your legs, you know. And he takes three strides and he's from base to base. And it really helps him out in the outfield, too. So he's sort of unique in his build. But he just does everything right, you know. And he also, don't forget, he had all those numbers batting mostly second in the lineup, too. You know, he wasn't batting third or fourth. And his increase in slugging was unbelievable. It's going to be interesting to see how that goes for the rest of his career with the Brewers. If he just had a freakish year that he'll never be able to repeat, or if he's going to be a 30 home run guy every year now.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. I feel like we're due for a little bit of a disappointment there just because I'm not sure we can expect those specific numbers. Certainly that slugging percentage, which is one of the, really when it comes down to it, one of the like 25 best second half sluggings in the history of baseball. Like his numbers are that crazy. Right. I don't think we can expect him to hit 36 home runs every year, but I guess I don't know. I mean, maybe, like
you
said,
you're going to be disappointed if you expect him to have a historic season every year.
Sure, of course.
I mean, we just ran the numbers where he's either first, second, or third in every single offensive category of note. And so, unless he's going to do that, if he's going to do that every year for the rest of his career, he's going to go to the Hall of Fame, you know. And so,
yeah, you're right.
So, I think you will be disappointed. And if you expect him to have a historic season every year, because who does, you know? And but there's no reason why you can't expect him to be a really good player and do very well.
Going back to when he was acquired, that famous January 25th evening when the Brewers announced the signing of Lorenzo Cain and the trade to acquire Christian Yelich for four minor leaguers, including pretty high-profile guys, Asan Diaz, Lewis Brinson, and Monty Harrison, as well as Jordan Yamamoto, who's actually done very well for them, kind of as the fourth guy in that trade. Going back to that night, we know that at that point the Brewers don't really need outfielders. I mean, you could always add somebody, but that wasn't an area of emphasis. I guess, what was your initial thought? Do you remember when they announced those two moves, but especially the Yelich trade, what jumped out to you about that? Other than, I mean, they're getting a good player, but they're giving up a lot. Like, what were some of the things that you thought in that moment?
Well, nobody thought they would be doing both things at once, you know, and it took some real out-of-the-box thinking to do both. As a matter of fact, team owner Mark Attanasio, you know, related a humorous story where when they had the Yelich trade completed and they were about to cross the finish line with the Cain signing a free agency, where Mark says, he asked David, do we really need both? And of course, the general manager is going to always say, of course we need both, you know, because they want every good player you can. So I'll never forget, we were the beat writers were on a conference call with David Stearns about the Yelich trade. Because you know the news had broken, and we did a conference call, and he said, "Well, guys, I just want to give you a heads up. You're probably going to be hearing about another move any time now. Probably tomorrow. I just want to give you a heads up that you know we're doing something else too," which was nice of him to do, so to give us the heads up. And then I think it was Adam McAlvey of MLB.com said, "Would that be signing Lorenzo Cain? Because he was monitoring Twitter, and somebody popped it out on Twitter." And he goes, "Oh, that's out there already, huh?" And so they literally almost happened simultaneously. And, you know, Stern says that was not the intent. It's not like they put the brakes on one so that they would cross the finish line together. It's just, you know, just one of those rare instances where negotiations that had been going on for weeks and weeks and weeks all of a sudden came to a conclusion at the same time. But, you know, I've written about it many times since January 25th. 2018 is going to be just one of the most historic days in Brewers history. Look what it did. I think we can say it put them within a game of the World Series, making those two moves. I mean, how often, no matter how good players are, do they both exceed expectations to the level of what those two guys did? You know, they transformed the team and did everything that could have been hoped for and more. And it's no coincidence that the Brewers broke through and went to the playoffs after making that trade. And I give Attanasio and Stearns credit for recognizing that the rebuild was ahead of schedule and deciding to push the accelerator down and go for it. You know, they could have been cautious and just kept building from within and keep their prospects too. You know, they traded a lot of prospects for Yelich, and but prospects also are currency. And I think the one thing that's interesting about Stearns as general manager, he's not afraid to make moves at the major league level, and he's also not afraid to trade prospects. You know, he did it a lot in July and August, when they were adding players like Mike Moustakas and Joaquin Soria and Jonathan Scope, who didn't work out that well, but still prospects were traded for him. So they have not been hesitant to part with some of their top prospects to get players at the big league level that they think are going to push them over the finish line.
January 25th happens to be my mom's birthday, and I now very open with her that it's no longer the thing I think of when I think of January 25th. And she's
you're
okay with that.
On dangerous territory there.
She is a Brewers fan, so she's totally fine with that. She's on board with that. But I did want to keep talking about what you're saying here, that the offseason worked so well and the bold moves, and maybe not just because they acquired Yelich and Kane, but curious how that's the success of those moves and the success of the team emboldens them as we head into this offseason, because it feels like this team could easily add another big, you know, somebody that we're not thinking about or talking about through the trade market in particular. I've got to think that we could see the same type of thing. Maybe it even involves somebody as high profile as Keston Hira, even though that it's hard to imagine the Brewers parting with him because he's just tearing up the Arizona Fall League and has had such a tremendous year. But it's definitely not off the table, I would think.
Yeah, I'd be personally shocked if Keston Hira was traded, because he does look like he's going to be somebody special, and it looks like he won't be that far away from the major leagues. It's going to be interesting to see what they do at second base this offseason, because they do have the biggest decision they probably have to make is with Jonathan Scope. He's got he's in arbitration for the final year. He's probably going to go to $10 million or so in salary in his final year of arbitration. So they have to decide whether they want to even tender him a contract, because if they pay him $10 million and he continues to struggle, then it's going to be a real burden on them. Teams that have $200 million payrolls can afford to make a $10 million mistake, but teams with $90 to $100 million payrolls cannot. And so that's something, it's going to be very interesting that tender date comes up at the end of the month. And that's going to tell us a lot about what the Brewers' plans are when that date comes, as to whether Scope is still on the team or not. If they tender him a contract, then you have to assume Travis Shaw is probably going to go back to third and Scope's going to be the second baseman. If they don't tender Scope a contract, then let's wait and see what they do. Will they go get a third baseman, maybe make a run to re-sign Moustakas off free agency and keep Shaw at second? It's going to be interesting to see. If you assume Keston Hira might be ready to play in the big leagues at the latest in 2020, if not at sometime next season, then you don't need to make a long-range plan ahead of him at second base. You could maybe sign Scope, you know, just let him play his last year out under control and then go be a free agent, and then Hira's all of a sudden the second baseman. So I think that's where the variance is for me and the Brewers team. I think, you know, you still got Braun, Yelich, and Kane in the outfield. You still got Aguilar and right now Thames, but I think he's definitely a trade candidate at first. Arcia, you know, reestablished himself as the shortstop. And then I assume Pena and Kratz are still going to be the catchers, but we'll see on that. And so it kind of just leaves that second base, third base scenario as the question mark of how the team's going to go. So that'll be revealed over time. And but they might decide to strengthen their pitching staff some, although I will tell you they're very excited about the future with the three young pitchers, Peralta, Woodruff, and Burns. Teams like the Brewers that have payroll limitations need to develop starting pitching from within, because that is the highest cost in Major League Baseball right now, is what it costs to sign a Major League starting pitcher off the market. And so that you need to develop pitchers from within, and they're in a good position to do that right now.
So before I leave you, wanted to get your thoughts on a couple other developments outside of these more recent awards. There was an argument that Lorenzo Cain could have been MVP of this Brewers team, I'd say right up until September 1st, when Christian Yelich completely caught fire and sort of put an end to that conversation. But I definitely thought he was going to win a gold glove. Now, these are voted on by managers, and I think Rawlings probably has some input, too. This isn't a writer's award. But it was honestly stunning to me when Ender Inciarte of the Braves was given the center field gold glove in the National League and not Lorenzo Cain. This is a really tough award to sort of adjudicate because it's a little bit of eye test, and you only get to see players so many times over the course of a year if you're not covering the team every day. But how stunning was it to you when Lorenzo Cain was not named the Gold Glove winner in the National League?
It was surprising just because we saw him every day. You know, Inciarte had a very good year in center, and I wonder if he played a lot more games than Cain. I wonder if that was a deciding factor for the coaches and managers who voted. They were sort of the same in a lot of the defensive metrics. I think Cain was 20 runs saved and Inciarte 17. Cain did have a lot more assists. But, yeah, when I went back and looked at it, the only thing I could see where Inciarte really had him was in innings played and games played. And so whether that was a factor, I don't know. And, the other thing that it seems like to me, just from watching the Gold Glove Awards over time, is if you win the first one, you're more likely to win a second and a third one. You know, it's just you do see a lot of multiple winners. Now, Inciarte wasn't in that category, but like you could really have made a case that Manny Pena had a better defensive year than Yadier Molina, but Molina just always wins the Gold Glove, and it's as long as he keeps playing, it just looks like he's going to keep winning it. And I think managers and coaches do look at the guys who won the previous years and said, well, it's got to still be him, right? He's still got to be the best player. So sometimes it becomes a career achievement award and not a 2018 award or 2017 or 19 for next year. So, but I did tweet out that if Lorenzo Cain didn't win the Gold Glove this year, he's probably never going to win it. And I do feel that way because he just can't play any better than that.
Yeah, we got to get that guy a career achievement award because he's been one of the best defenders in baseball since about 2013 and still does not have a gold glove on his mantle. Seems kind of strange. Maybe he'll get one of those Oscar awards maybe down the line when he has a so-so defensive year, but they got to give him one. Maybe he'll get one.
Well, I do think there is a general agreement out there that he's the best center fielder going right now that does not have a gold glove award.
Definitely. I didn't think we'd be talking about the Cincinnati Reds in an offseason podcast, but they've kind of made some commotion here. They swooped in and they grabbed Derek Johnson, the Brewers pitching coach, who's been credited for a lot of the success the team has had these past couple years. Derek Johnson going to the Reds to serve in the same capacity. They also then got a hitting coach, the Dodgers' Turner Ward, former Brewer, who obviously had some success in L.A. Now he's going to be the hitting coach in Cincinnati, so that's kind of a surprise. You know, you and a lot of other people sort of downplayed the idea that there was any sort of discontent in the Brewers clubhouse among the managerial ranks. Darnell Coles left to take the hitting coach position in Arizona. Lee Tunnel was also dismissed as bullpen coach. But And I'm sure that's true. I'm sure that these are just separate circumstances and it's not a trend per se. But is there anything that Brewers fans should be nervous about or read into it to know that they're, the top two assistant coaches are now choosing to go elsewhere off of a team that got within one game of the World Series?
Yeah, well, they should be nervous about losing them, but they should not be nervous about the circumstances. It looks bad to some when three coaches are gone at the same time, one dismissed and two leaving of their own volition. But to the best of my knowledge, they were all three individually separate situations. You know, Darnell Coles had been the Brewers hitting coach for 4 years, I believe. And that's a long time to be the team's hitting coach. I think there's 12 or 13 teams this offseason who are changing their hitting coach. So it's almost 50% of the teams are doing it. And if you look, a 2 or 3 year reign as a hitting coach kind of is a long one with one team. And I think there's a lot of burnout there. I do think it's at some point you want to get a different voice. I think Darnell just thought he had done all he could do with the Brewers and it was time to go find something else. And, he quickly landed in Arizona. So that shows you that he was coveted as a major league hitting coach. Only the Brewers know why they dismissed Lee Tunnel, but the Derek Johnson situation, from all I can gather, was a scenario where another team really coveted him. They found, he had an opening in his contract where he had not been renewed yet for the next year. They swooped in and made him just an incredible offer, I understand, probably more than the Brewers felt comfortable paying coaches. One thing I will tell you is There's no segment of Major League Baseball that's more underpaid than the coaches are. You know, I think a lot of them are doing good to even make $100,000 a year. When you consider the Major League minimum player salary is over $500,000, that gives you an example. Nobody works harder. They're the first guys to arrive every day and the last guys to leave. And when the team's going well, they don't get as much credit as they deserve. And when the team's not going well, they get way more blame than they deserve. And so it's almost a thankless position. And people just think that, they can be replaced at the drop of a hat. So I think the Derek Johnson thing hurts bad because he was a great pitching coach who did a lot of good things with the pitching staff. And they're just going to have to find another one now. You know, they plucked him out of the Cubs farm system, and nobody really knew much about him until the Brewers hired him, even though he had done great things at Vanderbilt University. And so they're just going to have to find another one now. I don't know if they'll do it internally or externally. You know, they supposedly have hired a hitting coach, Andy Haynes, from the Cubs, but they haven't announced it yet. And I'm wondering if they're just waiting to fill all the positions on the staff, and then they'll announce them en masse. I kind of get the feeling that's what's going on. But I don't know that there was any connection between Andy Haynes and the Brewers other than they played the Cubs a lot. And the Cubs fired their hitting coach, you know, Chili Davis, after they struggled to score runs at the end of the season, and Haynes was his assistant. So they're going to definitely get some inside information on the Cubs when he comes over and is their hitting coach. So, you know, it's that staff had stayed together for all of Council's first 3 or 4 years, and now there's some changes, and I think that's way more common in baseball circles than we realize.
Yeah, I think what you say is true, especially about hitting coaches, the most thankless job in baseball, because we know the names of some pitching coaches like Don Gullett, you know, Leo Mazzoni, Derek Johnson kind of got up there. We don't know any of the hitting coaches. Like, I don't think even a good baseball fan could name more than maybe 5 hitting coaches around baseball.
Yeah, you know who your coaches are, but you don't know who any of the other coaches are.
Right, and they definitely get blamed more than they get credit for the hitting, more so than even pitching. You get so much blame as the hitting coach. It's very...
Yeah, and the hitting coaches are 50% psychiatrists than 50% coaches. You know what? They're trying to just keep guys' confidence up, pat them on the butt, and say you're going to be okay when things aren't going well. So, if you want to blame, you know, Darnell Coles for the struggles of any players on the team, then what did Christian Yelich ignore his coaching? You know, I don't think he did. So. You know, they're all good guys, but I can tell you that all three of those coaches are very good people. I got to know them all really well, and it's gonna the Darnell Coles thing won't hurt as bad as Derek Johnson because he's staying in the division and he's going to a team whose main problem is pitching. You know, the Reds' offense is tremendous, but they have trouble with their pitching. So if he improves their pitching, then it's gonna be another factor in the division the Brewers have to overcome.
This is true. I said Don Gullett. I meant Don Cooper. So maybe I'm wrong about pitching coaches too. But yes, thank you, sir. Tom Haudricourt. He is. You can find all his stuff at jsonline.com. He's the Brewers Journal Sentinel beat reporter. We'll be touching base again at some point in the off season, perhaps in January after the Brewers maybe make another big splash. But in the meantime, Tom, thanks for joining us again. We'll chat with you again real soon.
Okay. I'd like to wish all the, unless we have an emergency podcast I don't know about in the next week, we'd like to wish all of our listeners and readers a happy Thanksgiving.
Yes, and perhaps a Merry Christmas as well, but definitely won't talk before Thanksgiving. So safe travels to everyone out there, and enjoy the holiday. Thanks again, Tom. We'll chat with you again.
Thanks, JR.
Hope you enjoyed this off-season edition of the Milwaukee Brewers Journal Sentinel podcast. Find us on Apple Podcasts. Give us a review and rating. Let us know what you think. Thanks for everybody who's tuned in this year. We'll have more for you here in the off-season, but not on a week-by-week basis. We will catch up when there are some big roster moves or anything to discuss. Certainly we'll be back at it as spring training gets going in February and March. But thanks for tuning in. We had a lot of listeners and got progressively more and more as the year went on. Obviously it helps that the Brewers were good, but we definitely appreciate that you guys are appreciating us and finding some time in your commute or during your day to give us a listen. In addition to Apple Podcasts, we're on Stitcher, we're on Spotify. You can find us at goodoldfashionedjsonline.com. All the podcasts will go up on the Brewers page, on the sports page there. And in the meantime, you know, if you're hurting for more podcasts, don't forget we have a Milwaukee Bucks podcast that's been going once a week with Matt Velasquez and myself. That's a pretty good team. We definitely want to talk more about the Bucks as the season goes on because they are having a whale of a start to the 2018-2019 season. Maybe they might be the best team in the NBA. Not sure. There are plenty of contenders for that crown, notably the Toronto Raptors, which on this last episode I didn't mention at all and probably feel maybe a little negligent there that we didn't mention the Raptors in that conversation. But the Warriors and plenty of teams in the West still have a case as well. But the Bucks are very good, so we'll have a podcast for you every week there. Still keeping up with the Badgers. Got a Badgers podcast every week with myself and Jeff Patricus covering Wisconsin football primarily. The basketball season's underway. Not sure what we're going to do with the basketball just yet, but we will try to keep you updated a little bit on that as well. The Badgers pulling off a very nice win Tuesday night against Xavier. That's kind of put them a little bit back on the map, so that's something to follow along with as well. And even though I'm not involved, you should definitely check out our Packers podcast, Jim Ozarski and Tom Silverstein, every week breaking down, there are a number of podcasts a week, breaking down the games, but also with some updates from practice and various other storylines throughout the year. So hopefully you find all of that at jsonline.com. We appreciate your listenership once again. For Tom Hodricourt, I am J.R. Radcliffe. We'll catch you again soon.